What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? Close observers, who through words and images, strive to capture the details in fiction, history, art, and song. These are conversations from the pointed firs, invoking the spirit of place with artists and authors from Maine.
Okay. Seen. Most of the time, I do not want to be seen. I want people to leave me alone, to not coo or cluck, rubbing their hands up and down my arms like a stairway banister, using me to climb up. Why is it important for my work to be seen? For me to be seen as an artist, instead of just wacky, sensitive Christy. Oh, you know, Christy, the one with the hair. She's chubby, plump, fat, from Deer Isle. Had a shoe store. Worked at the chocolate store. You know, the one. Yeah, that's her. Well, now she thinks she's an artist. Right? Can you imagine? She takes pictures of dolls. Have you seen them? Creepy! She should take pictures of lobster boats, lighthouses, maybe another weird selfie. But here I am, wanting to be seen. People hug me, asking me what I've been up to, as they stand in a room with 40 photographs. I sigh, shrug. Ah, not much. They walk around the perimeter of the show of the images. They don't stop. They just slowly stroll, not even looking. Yeah. Do people buy your doll pictures, Christy? I want to answer, but I shrug. Why do you take pictures of dolls anyway? Ugh, and dead animals, and abandoned houses. Weird. I think you'd be better with boats, lighthouses, babies. I want to be seen. Rubbing my arm up and down, climbing. I shake you off. And I'm the one who's climbing the stairs. I'm seeing myself. And I love her in a way that is foreign and familiar. The best is yet to come. Love, you know, Christy, the one with the hair, the doll photographer. She's fat, but nice.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guest today is Christy Billings, poet and photographer, lifelong resident of Deer Isle and now Sedgwick, Maine. We will discuss her new book, Sea Witch, Photographs, Poems, and Forget-Me-Nots from a Mainer Growing Up, published in 2023 by Seapoint Books, Brooklyn, Maine. Christy, welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Well, thank you for having me, Peter.
Our little sanctuary grove of welcoming trees and enclosing, nurturing forests.
I like that.
As always, I start with the biography. Your book is astonishingly honest and tells a story that begins early in your life. And I wondered if you would just start with telling us a little bit about growing up in Stonington, family, fisherman, community.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me today. So I was born and raised in Stonington. I was born in the early 70s, so you can get an idea of of how old I am. My father was a fisherman, as well as most of my uncles. My great-grandfather was a fisherman. My grandfather was a fisherman. But all the men in my family definitely were involved in the fishing industry, as well as the women in my family, whether they were picking crab meat, working at the sardine factory, or what have you. So anyway, I grew up hearing a lot about the price of lobsters and how there weren't any, or how there weren't any scallops or what have you. So my mom was born and raised in Brooklyn, Maine, just across the bridge. And my mom and dad met each other at a basketball game in Deer Isle.
That's classic American romance.
Right there. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was dating somebody else.
Oh, even better.
And she liked my dad's Mustang, apparently. It's so funny because my dad's last name, Billings, my mom's last name, Eaton. And then if you've ever been
oh my goodness
to Deer Isle, you know yes. those are the names.
It's two branches of
definitely
of maybe even one family.
Perhaps. Everyone seems to be related.
Yeah.
So I have an older sister. She's 3 years older. Just, you know, there was just my sister and I. And I think from a young age, I would say that I don't think that I'm that unique per se, but perhaps to my parents I was, because I started dressing differently from the other kids in my age group. I started wearing wigs early on. I'm trying to think how old. So I would get my hair done at my mom's salon in Ellsworth, the big city. This was the 80s. I remember the first time I went into this hair salon, there were like these wigs for sale. And I was like, wow, there are wigs. You know, and before I would always see wigs at like Kmart or Woolworths maybe had wigs too. And I always was fascinated with them too, believe me. I loved it. At my mom's hair salon, they didn't have like the gray or the brown or the ash blonde. They had like pink and lavender and blue and all these funky kind of like pseudo punk. I don't even know why this woman had them. But anyway, I wanted desperately these wigs. My mom was like, what are you talking about? No. But I was like obsessed with like Boy George and Cyndi Lauper and Annie Lennox of the Eurythmics. And anyway, I saved my money. Actually, I think my mom bought me the first one, which was the lavender wig. And I started wearing them.
What age are we talking about?
So I think I was 9.
And when you think back on this, just out of sheer curiosity, can you interpret yourself at that time? What were you thinking? What was going on? Who in the world were you then? And you hadn't discovered that yet, but looking back, you may know.
So first of all, I had all these people I looked up to that were famous celebrities that were different compared to people in my hometown, for sure. They were colorful. Mm-hmm. And Cyndi Lauper was not androgynous, but the other two, definitely, Boy George and Annie Lennox. And for some reason, I just was so taken with them being colorful and the androgyny. I mean, I'm sure I wouldn't have said that as a kid. But to me, it was about the color and the expression of their dress. So I started wearing them to school and, you know, playing kickball in a pink wig or a blue wig. And but the reason really why I wore wigs is because my mother wouldn't let me dye my hair yet. So it was like this gateway until she was like, all right, I guess you're nutty enough to want to spend $40 on a wig. You can dye your hair. But I just didn't really, even at that age of being 9 or 10, I had no interest looking like my peers. None.
Well, what about your peers? You had to see them every day in your lavender wig and on the kickball field. And did it make any difference?
So, like, you know, in elementary school, kids are definitely a little bit nicer than they are in middle school or high school. Kids definitely still would, like, take my wigs off and thought it was a great, fun game. But growing up on an island, you know, you're a tight community, especially at Stonington Elementary. It's so funny because I don't think anyone thought it was weird mm-hmm. at all. I think they were like, oh, that's just Christy. I don't really think my parents never talked to me about it, thinking that they thought it was weird. I imagine they thought it was a phase and that I would grow out of it. And I imagine my teachers probably thought that too. But the kids didn't seem to care. They were like, eh, whatever.
But you evolved to to goth.
Yep. So then, you know, I wear my wigs, then I'm allowed to dye my hair. So that was a big thing. And that's like the next step. And then I've been into music since I was 9 or 10, you know, like Culture Club and early New Wave. And then, you know, my sister, who's older than me, you know, a little further advanced than me, like introduces me to some, I guess you could say, not really punk rock, but more new wave. And I become really interested in that. And so then I guess I definitely started looking differently and edgier and definitely goth or punk, whatever. But eventually settling on goth, where I dressed in black and dyed my hair black. And I had, for a while, I had like my hair shaved or my head shaved with long black bangs. But I was like, at that point, a depressed, very much so, it's not funny, a depressed teenager. And I definitely felt like I did not fit on the island at that point in my life. I was like, what am I doing here? You know, like, I was definitely the black sheep, or that's how I felt.
Well, it is a small town. It is a time, all times are changing, but it was a time of a certain kind of change, social change and identities. It is also an island, which is different than a small town. It sort of amplifies the smallness of a small town. And it's not easy to escape. Did you feel trapped?
Oh, well, as a teenager, I definitely did. I couldn't wait to leave or wanting to leave. I was just like, nobody gets it. Or at least I didn't feel like they did. Because, you know, I don't know if it was the depression or I don't think so, because now as a grown adult woman, I still am drawn to a lot of the stuff I was drawn to as a kid. The outsiders. I always rooted for the underdog.
Well, it's hard to be outside when everybody inside's the same.
Right.
And so there are different levels of reaction. Some can be brutal and cruel.
Mm-hmm.
Some can be tentatively welcome, at least tolerating. But there's a kind of dark side to it that is part of what we're trying to talk about. We
Yes.
are trying to talk about the spirit of Maine. And it's not just Stonington or Deer Isle. You go up and down the coast in fishing communities, they're all small.
Mm-hmm.
They all have this sort of concentration of work and community and opinion. And it strikes me is that when you're having to deal with that situation, you have choices, I think, or maybe you don't. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, was your only choice to escape, or could you have stayed and adapted and been somebody else? I mean, the other young women on the island of your age didn't do what you did.
No, not really. So I think when I graduated high school, like I briefly went off to college, I dropped out really soon and came back to the island and was miserable, like super miserable, because I was like, geez, I freaking failed. But it was kind of like this eye-opener for me from, you know, growing up on Deer Isle, kind of a big fish in a small pond, for sure. Like, you know, I was the weirdo of the island. And then I went and moved to right outside of Providence, Rhode Island, to go to school to study writing. And then I shared a room with someone that got a Mercedes for their graduation gift. And I was like a fish out of water, literally. I was like, I don't understand this. And like, there were stables at my college with horses. And I was like, what is happening? Like, I just could not relate, at least with the people in my dorm. And I was like, oh, God, I want to go back to the island. Like, at least, like, I understood it. Like, I didn't understand. I'm trying not to be super judgy, but I definitely did not understand wealth or class from the people I met at college. Because, like, some of these people did not have a hand-me-down car or, you know, they got whatever they wanted, which my parents definitely gave me whatever I wanted too, within reason. But, you know, like, I didn't go to Disney World. We didn't go on family trips unless it was to go look at a boat for my dad.
Did you ever go on the water?
Oh, yeah. I definitely went fishing a couple times when I was a little kid with my dad, and I got paid a nickel, a bait bag, for baiting bait bags. And I liked it, but, you know, I was a kid, so I was like, hey, I want to get up early. And to be honest, I was really close with my dad as a little girl. I always went with him down to the shop when I was a kid on Sundays. But when I was a teenager, I had a very hard relationship with him. I don't think he knew how to deal with me or communicate with me. Because I, like I said, I wasn't like other kids. I definitely wasn't like other girls.
Well, we come from a generation where parents have trouble communicating with their children de facto. So let me ask you another one. Let's move on. And when did you write your first poem?
I was probably in middle school, maybe before. It was terrible. But anyway, let's say I was 14. And then at 15, I definitely became more interested in like Edna St. Vincent Millay, you know, Maine poet. And then I moved on to Sylvia Plath.
Let's stop with St. Vincent Millay, for example. So you were taught her in school. So you may have read the first poem that
probably in English class. Probably, yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you remember the poems that affected you at the beginning?
That's so sad. I don't at all. I remember I have a bunch of her books still, but I liked her. I thought she was, and I read like some information about her personal life, and I thought, oh, she definitely seemed like she was a little tortured. Mm-hmm. She was beautiful, and I could relate to her in a little bit because she was from Midcoast Maine, but I quickly realized, I was like, I don't like poetry that rhymes, which is really funny that I was like, I can't write. I can't relate that. And then so when I discovered Sylvia Plath, to me, I have something tattooed by her on my chest.
Can you quote that? I was going to ask you about it at some point along the way. Do you remember the line? Of course.
Oh, yeah.
It's engraved on your body.
Well, it's from The Bell Jar, mm-hmm. Of course. Everyone's like, oh, no. I'm like, no, it's really uplifting it. So the quote is, I took a deep breath and listened to the old brag of my heart. I am, I am, I am. And I had it tattooed after my dad passed. And to me, it was like, you got this. It's okay. Because that was a dark time for me.
But it is a declaration of independence.
Yeah.
It says that no matter where I'm born, where I come from, how I'm treated, what my family thinks, what my friends or non-friends think, I have the power to be who I want to be.
Exactly.
You talked to me once about how you didn't like being talked about as authentic. But in fact, that's you have that reality about you. And part of it has to do with some kind of defense or determination not to let anything else matter but what you feel or what is real. And I have to think that's a hugely powerful inspiration to make poetry.
Yes. I mean, like when people read my poems or people hear me read my poems, which you will soon, they're always like, oh, my. Oh, I mean, not, oh my God, because that makes me sound like I'm...
If you're just joining us, this is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming online and archived at weru.org, and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm your host, Peter Neal. I'm speaking today with Christy Billings, poet, photographer, and collector, and author of Sea Witch, Photographs, Poems, and Forget-Me-Nots from a Mainer Growing Up, published by Sea Point Books. Well, let's go there. Let's pick one and start. One that's sort of in the context of what we're talking about, this sort of self-identity and declaration.
All right, let's see if I can find a good one. Okay. This is a good one. Middle-aged woman. More and more this happens. I pause. I stop. Where did this come from? A new obstacle. And this too. Where did I put that? Late yesterday at a tax office, rummaging and rummaging through my fake Gucci wallet, trying to find my ID, just gift cards and receipts, feeling and looking old. Where did that fat roll come from? I have to laugh. Really? It came from chips. It came from cookies. It came from stress. Where did all these wrinkles and discolorations come from? I kick rocks in front of me as I walk down streets. Nothing is ever ironed out. Nothing in my life has been smooth sailing. What did I expect? Where did I put that bill? Why is my car rusting out? Here I am, pushing 50, and I've done this and that, but I can't even make up my mind about what haircut I want. Why is it on other people I see age, and it is beautiful, but on me, it looks like another bruised fruit, not even good enough to make banana bread with, or applesauce, just straight to the compost. Maybe that's it. I have never felt the, yeah, oh yeah, yeah, me thing. I've picked at myself hard, so much that I've bled. I've got scars. I've got fat, the rust, the infinite dust. But I'm still kicking rocks down the street as I walk, singing to myself. I giggle here and there. People tell me the reason why they like me is that I'm real. Yeah, I'm real. Like the bill that you forgot to pay, the lie that you casually tell, the bra that doesn't quite fit. I dig in. I'm non-threatening to most people because I don't bother covering up my faults and flaws. There simply aren't enough creams and concealers. Go for the fiberglass Bondo. Smooth sailing. That's for losers. Smudged lipstick, chewed nails, but a belly full of laughter. My body is like a fluffernutter sandwich. To hell with it. I don't put the bra on. I roll my eyes at myself. You can't be too serious. I'm a middle-aged woman. I am salty, sassy, and I know when to shut up and just listen. Tired to move my fat ass in corduroys. Swish, swish, swish. God, where's my phone? Where did I put my coffee? Have to laugh.
I am.
Yeah. Okay. This one is called Snowman. A body. My body. A melted snowman. Under my vintage clothes with rips and tears, a few tattoos, always cold hands, feelings of inadequacy, as sexual as a clown. I've never gotten the hang of it. People in sweatpants and pajamas, more sexually confident, even with margaritas and all that. I've always danced alone. Lipstick, eyeliner, sassy, funny. A body made of rotten apples. If you were to get on top of me, I'd be applesauce. Another windstorm coming. The waitress sweeps up bits of food and paper wrappers. For your straws, Diet Coke, jumbo margarita. I'm just sitting here in the old fast food restaurant eating fast food Mexican food, wondering why I never got the hang of being a woman. Being human. I mean, I got the sensitive part down and the stereotypical nonsense. I guess I never got there in therapy. Just one of those stereotypical menopausal ladies, old punk rock artist types, overweight, used to party hard. I'm fun, like one of those inflatable advertising blow-ups, waving my arms around, car wash, tires, something insignificant, but necessary in real everyday life. My parents had a ritual. Saturday night, sex night, the music would come on, the bedroom door lock clicked. My mom would moan along with Minute Rice, Hamburger Helper, and Kool-Aid. I'm ka-splat. Applesauce, bits of core, sexual as a clown at a kid's birthday party.
Applesauce. We made applesauce. Somewhere along the way, you found a camera.
I did.
Poets make pictures all the time, but they make pictures in words and resist the camera in some ways because the camera is too easy. On the other hand, photographers will tell you how hard it is to capture a good photograph. Tell me about how that happened.
It was pre-pandemic. I borrowed a camera from actually a customer of mine. I work in an antique shop. More about that later. But he lent me an old digital Nikon, and it was November of 2019, and I totally fell in love with it. I've had really good friends who have gone to art school for photography, and I've always been interested by photography. I bought my husband a Pentax camera one year when we first got together. But anyway, but I've never allowed myself to actually pick up a camera and play with it. So then COVID happened. I was laid off from work. Like most people, I had a lot of time to study nothing or everything. And then I just was so introspective, and I started really taking pictures like every day. I went out and bought the same identical digital Nikon camera, and I loved it. I still love that camera. But now I'm more into film. And it's funny because when I first started taking pictures, like sure, I did landscapes and stuff about the ocean because I'm so all about the ocean. But then I started taking pictures of like my collections, mainly dolls and toys and stuffed animals, because I wasn't really around people. And it's a lot easier to photograph an inanimate object than a person, for sure.
When you got started in the old days without digital photography, mm-hmm. there was a whole lot of talk about the frame and how you had to anticipate the photograph before you took it. And there were certain formulas that you followed in the hopes that you'd get that creative accident. When you get a digital camera with an automatic advance, you can take 1,000 photographs right. and pick one.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different than poetry, it seems to me. Poetry, you really can't have 1,000 versions of a line. You sort of have to get there pretty quickly at the beginning. So I've always wondered if there was some sort of antithesis, some sort of opposition, creative opposition between taking a photograph and writing a good line of poetry.
Say you have your phone or your digital camera, whatever digital format you're using, you can take 1,000,000 pictures, but you might only get one good shot. Same way with poetry, for that matter. You can write pages and pages, but it might be crap. You might only have one good line. But film, especially, when you actually go out and purchase the film, I mean, same thing. I mean, I don't take a ton of pictures, but usually, like, I take 10 rolls worth of photos in 3 weeks or whatever. And then I'm always like, ooh, that means, you know, like, over 300 pictures. And if I get 10 that I like, I'm like totally like, yeah, but you never get that.
More than half your book is photographs.
Yes.
And they're different simply because it's a different medium, but they're very much the same in terms of the eccentricity, the sort of strange perspective and angle, and sort of the emotional quality that you capture in particular in human photographs, not the dolls and stuff.
Right.
Come to that later. But even those have expressions that look entirely human when you look at them closely. Was that preconceived, or did you just fall into that as something to occupy your COVID time?
I don't think it was preconceived, no. But definitely when I think about like my photographs of people, and I would have to say the two people that I document the most in my poetry and photography, my mother and my husband, and he puts up with it. He's always like, stop taking my picture. And my mom gets like that sometimes.
Is there a particular poem that addresses this sort of equivalency between taking a photograph and observing through a poem?
Oh, there's got to be. Well, I'll read this one. This is about my mom, too. I should also say, like, when I do readings for my book, I don't tend to read about my mother publicly. The last time I did, I ended up crying like a freak. And I cry a lot, but I didn't really want to cry about my mother in front of people.
Just, I was in the room.
Yeah, you know.
I know.
It was raw,
and it was beautiful.
No, oh. Well, that's nice, because I was like, oh my God, why did I do that? All right, so this one is called Evaluation. Christy, What do you hope to get out of this appointment today? I begin. A long ramble, but I do answer. I want you to know where we are in this disease and what to expect. What can I do to help my mom and myself for the stages of this difficult road we are on? The social worker commends me, applauds me of how supportive and intuitive I am, asks me if I had training. I laugh. I tell her, as hard as it feels right now, I know that it's going to get much, much worse, and I want to be equipped with knowing how to navigate and make sure I am present with my mom and her needs, and for me to feel supported also. What I don't tell her is that I'm exhausted. I do tell her I have a great husband, a great doctor, that I'm on Zoloft, that I have a few incredibly supportive friends, that I have a fantastic Nana, and an aunt who has given me great advice. I don't tell her that I'm worried that I'll fail my mother. I don't tell her that I'm worried that I'll end up with this disease too. I do tell her I had hoped to travel. I give her the slightest smile. I look up and I start to cry. She shakes the tissue box and I nod. I don't tell her that I can't finish this poem because even writing the words feels too hard. So I'll vacuum. I'll do laundry and get ready to attend an art reception. My art will hang. I will too. Splayed out, hammered and screwed, with stretch marks and training wheels, glitter and googly eyes, discolored teeth and chewed fingernails. Oh, hi. Oh, yeah, that's my photograph. It's Jesus and a cheetah. See? I shrug. I roll my eyes. Yeah.
In the biography on the cover of your book, there's a kind of conceit amongst writers, particularly male writers, that they have to show that they've lived life. So they've become stevedores and professional wrestlers, and they've worked in kitchens. You know, they've gone to sea. They add a kind of quality of life as if some work history makes their art somehow better because it's real. Mm-hmm. In the flap copy in your book, it's described as this. Christie is a collector of stories, emotions, dolls, feelings, wigs, mannequin parts, record albums, memories, laughter, vintage clothing, beauty, shells, and ideas from Edna St. Vincent Millay to Charles Bukowski. Well, that's quite a career. That's quite a work career. but it's all true. Let's talk about the collections.
Yes. Okay, so I can't talk about collecting until I talk about my mother is a collector.
Oh.
And her mother was a collector. So as a little kid, I was brought to yard sales, estate sales, and auctions. And as a little girl, the first thing that I collected was, like a lot of little kids, like toys, obviously. So I collected dolls and matchbox cars and stuffed animals and that sort of thing. And then when I got a little older, I started buying records, you know, 45s from Woolworths or wherever, Ames, Zayers. And I got a little older, and then I started collecting religious icons. I have a lot of them. I'm not seeking them out anymore, but I was super into that, the imagery of Christ and Mary. But I also went to church as a little kid, and I loved it. My parents did not go to church. My grandmother took me, and I went to youth group, and I've kept going until I was like almost a teenager because I loved it. But again, I think I feel bad saying this, but it wasn't so much about the Bible's teachings. It was more about the art. I was really into the art. As a little kid, I was really interested in fashion. And as a teenager, I started shopping only at like Salvation Army or Goodwill or thrift stores. And then when I moved on my own, you know, I don't know. I collected books and stuff like that. But really, this is an awful thing to say, but when I bought a house is when I really started collecting. Because, you know, when you're moving around from apartment to apartment, you're like, I don't want to do that. But I bought a house, and then, much to the chagrin of my husband, I really started collecting.
There's a difference between collecting and hoarding.
I know.
Which one are you?
I hate to say this. I think I'm really more of a hoarder, and I hate that about myself. My late grandmother was a hoarder as well.
Well, hoarding implies no discernment. Collecting implies that you're making an aesthetic judgment or a value calculation. You're curating something. Out of 100 pieces, you're only picking this one or that one.
Well, so my problem is, since I work in an antique shop, so sometimes I get things to resell. And then there's other things I just like fall in love with and I can't part. But when I look at my house, it makes me feel bad because you can't see everything the way I want it to be seen because there's too much. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like that is exactly how I am as a person. I want certain things to be seen, but overall there's just too much.
Well, you rotate your displays. In a museum, you have a collection of 20 million pieces, and
right.
You can only put 1,000 on view at any given time. So you rotate your collection, and you exhibit according to theme or according
right.
to feeling or according to some historical anniversary. Or so you could curate your house in a way.
Yeah, I mean, so if people were to come into, like, my dining room, like, I have an old jukebox from the 80s, and then I've got, like, you know, a mid-century modern hutch full of my cameras, and then there's all these doll heads. I have a bunch of mannequins. I'd say in the past few years, I've gotten really into mannequins.
That's really great. You don't have to have any parties because they're always all the guests are already
yeah.
are already there.
When people are like, oh, I have dolls I want you to have, I'm like, I'm not interested in a pristine porcelain doll or some super realistic mannequin. I want them to have cracks and flawed or whatever.
Can you extrapolate from this an aesthetic? What's the common denominator between all these objects and yourself?
Well, I guess I think I'm flawed. Like this Island of the Misfit Toys, you know?
Is there a poem?
I'm going to read Old Dressers. I love this poem. Old dressers. Old dressers sold, lugged up and down steps, oak, nice hardware, open drawers and find wallpaper liners, pencils roll back and forth with teeth marks and worn erasers, travel size soaps from hotels, a lone handkerchief. I oil the wood, I wax the drawers, I wonder what you were like. What your bedroom looked like, what your face looked like, the sound of your laugh, how your shoulders slumped. I put the price tag on your three-drawer dresser, and I sell it to a family who just moved here. Just bought a house in Hancock County. They used to live somewhere else. They have big dreams. The dresser will go into their bedroom, and they're going to fill it with organic cottons, silk under things. Their shoulders do not slump. They wear L.L. Bean boots, wool jackets. Their names aren't old, like Stanley or Basil or Pearl. I help carry the dresser out and set it in the back of their SUV. The pencil with teeth marks and a stained handkerchief thrown in the wastebasket.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Furs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming online and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfurs.org. I'm your host, Peter Neal. I'm speaking today with Christy Billings, poet, photographer, and collector, and author of Sea Witch, Photographs, Poems, and Forget-Me-Nots from a Mainer Growing Up, published by Sea Point Books. The focus of this program is to explore and capture this elusive concept of the spirit of Maine. I would like you to read, before we go any further, I'm Falling, because I think it pertains to what we might conclude out of all this in relationship to this idea that there is a kind of collective spirit, light and dark and versatile and pervasive, that does connect us all.
Okay. I'm Failing is the real title.
Oh, dear.
No, I know. It's the same thing.
Oh, it's the same thing.
It is. I'm failing. You and me. I want to help you, not bully you. I wish I could be tough. I try to act to you that I'm okay, that this isn't a big deal, but it is. I want the best for you. It is a relatively new role for me to be a parent, to try to be supportive, yet make sure things get done, to balance things out. I wonder what Honk would say. I wonder what his mother thinks. I think I can imagine what Holly would say. I just have to keep trying, to be gentle, to hold your hand, to make phone calls, go to appointments, see doctors, bankers, and lawyers, all smiling behind a mask and looking at you with love. Try not to show my anxiety and my worry that I am not strong enough to do this, to be the best daughter for you. I wonder if it's normal to have my mind race night after night. I dodged my doctor appointment this week. Sometimes facing things is hard. It must run in our family. You blame the icy driveway. I didn't want you to fall. I offer to come get you, to borrow my husband's car. You decline. I bite my tongue, not wanting to scold. I, too, didn't want to face my doctor, literally, and tell her the meds aren't working. I'm stressed, and I'm not sleeping. I rescheduled, and I'll reschedule your appointment, too, Mom. We have to do this. I wish I was tough. I wish I wasn't failing.
So that poem is about humanity, aspiration. It's also about vulnerability and failure. And when I read it, I started to think about it as a kind of anthem to the other, in a sense that we're all faced with all these stresses, and there's dark and there's light, and it's happening more and more, and we read about everyone's sort of collective depression and all the things that get up to that. We watch drugs, we watch children destroy their lives, we watch adults destroy their lives, and it can be really disheartening. And so honesty is one way to deal with it. And what we're talking about is the sort of discovery of self. And I think all your poems are about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, because a lot of people don't want to allow that to be and to be public. And so your honesty to me is really courageous and moving. Goth, for example, I mean, it's a dark thing. It's a reaction to a part of your life which can be dark.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that can also be liberating to others, including yourself, and people with whom you find relationship through that kind of eccentricity and independence. What does this have to do with the spirit of Maine?
Well, when I think of Maine, my version of Maine, old Maine, I think of the crabs, the hermit crabs, literally. You know, people that will wave to you, but they want to keep their distance, you know. There's definitely people like I'll invite in to see me, to really see me and see my mess, my hot mess. But there's so many people I don't want to see that, like, you know, like, you can go into someone's house and sit in their parlor and drink tea or whatever, but how many people do you actually allow to really see the real you? And like, I think, you know, when I think of Maine, the old Maine, I know there's this couple I know that are in their 90s that live in Brooklyn, my mom's hometown, and I go see them a couple times a month, and I find their house to be fascinating. It's old, It's probably from the 1800s or maybe even the late 1700s. It was a farm. I knew this woman who's in her 90s, her mother. It was my mom's godmother. The house is full of stories. Literally. Everywhere I look, there's a story. The wallpaper, the knick-knack paddywhacks, the teacups, vases. And then there's this couple. They are full of stories. They are ignored by most people because they're old. Literally, they feel, people think they have nothing to offer. They're this just retired couple living on a hardly any income. They're crabby, truly crabby, curmudgeons. They're brash. They can be rude, as old manners can often be perceived as rude because they don't want anything to change. And they see everything changing around them and they're mad. So then it's funny that I get to sit there in their parlor, this wackety whack lady with pink or purple hair, and they let me pick up a camera. The guy is much more interested in me taking his photo than the lady. And I write poems about them. And they tell me this crazy stuff about people committing suicide from back in the day and how there's been mental illness in this family or that family or this person's always been poor and that person never had anything to live for. And I don't know. This is like what Maine is to me. Like sometimes people will talk smack about people, but they still show up for you. You know what I mean? And the last time I saw this couple, so I took a picture of the woman as she was making fish sticks, frozen fish sticks, at her old, old stove. I've got my camera on her. And then she says, "Christy, I want to shove that camera right up your butt. I'm so tired of this." And then I say, "Oh, see, so you want me to have a colonoscopy?" And then they start laughing and I have an aunt who was dying of cancer, who's now passed. I don't know if this is gelling, but like Maine to me is like, it's hard. It is hard. You struggle to make ends meet, you know. I'm dealing with this storm damage and, you know, generational land that I don't know if I can build. I don't know if it's worth building. And to me, like, as someone who's been in retail and going to be in retail till I stop working, I never, ever would have had the chance or opportunity to own oceanfront property if it were not left to me. And now, you know, whatever you want to say about climate change and obviously very real, but now I'm like, oh my God. So this property I love is being taken away from me, nature, but I'm mad because I'm like, okay, I didn't come from money. And this is again about Maine and class. And I know that makes some people really uncomfortable.
Well, I think it's fine to talk about it. I mean, it's good for everyone to hear.
It is good for everyone to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. I've thought about this a lot because it underlies this the whole idea of these conversations from the Pointed Furs. And I keep trying to find, I ask the same question to everybody. Everybody gives me a different facet as part of the answer. And my thought now, and I've written it this way, is that Maine has this long history of eccentric individuals
mm-hmm.
who are a kind of gypsy collective.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all come from all these different origins. We come from all these different places. We come from all of these different levels of income and rags to riches, riches to rags. It's the tinker and it's the songster and the storyteller and the people that are out honoring the old ways, the old things, the old values, maintaining memories and traditions. Because mm-hmm. we're very interested in our traditions
Definitely.
And holding on to them
yes.
as part of our own collective authenticity, right? And we do it through keeping and we do it through sharing. Your book is just exactly that. You've collected, you've kept, and you've shared. And I think that's one way of defining the spirit of Maine as the holding on to these things as a kind of stalwart and enduring dedication to a spirit. As elusive it may seem, it is real, and you know it when you see it. You know it when you feel it. You know it when you hold it in your hand. You know it when you see it in a photograph.
I agree.
Or in a conversation with a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
And I just keep wanting these conversations and work like yours to be shared out there in ways that help people to value this, not to dismiss it, not to think it's old-fashioned and irrelevant, but that it's valuable and it is pertinent to the moment and to the future. Christy, one more.
Well, should I read something relatively new?
Sure.
Okay. This one is untitled. Seabirds leave their feathers on the beach, seashells, bones, treasures to bend and bow down to. What do I leave on the shore? Snippets of poetry, tears, hair dye, missing earrings and bobby pins. Mostly, I leave my love. An antique patchwork quilt, stained and faded from time of love and gratitude, rolled up to the weathered steps, churned by the waves, and seaweed. I leave you, my love, and each periwinkle, each mussel shell, chipmunks and seagulls take my garland of love and they wrap it around the rocks, the trees. I am humbled, nude as a clam, nude as a sand dollar, naked as a tree in December. I'm chipped, cracked, but like a starfish, I grow back. The tide brings me in, out like the moon. And life, the crows, the fox, and coyotes, eyes glittering, the cycle of life, drops of blood, like winter berries, stain the path. Boats have been put to bed, curtains hang, a veil of modesty, a finger, crook, a nail, mother of pearl, a claw, dripping blood, taking flight until late November air.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I like that poem.
We'll end with that. My guest today has been Christy Billings, author of Sea Witch, Photographs, Poems, and Forget-Me-Nots from a Mainer Growing Up, published by Sea Point Books, a unique evocation of the spirit of Maine. My guest next time will be Siri Beckman, woodcut artist, whose new book, Engraving a Sense of Place, The Prints of Siri Beckman, has been recently published by Down East Books. Sarah Orne Jewett published her American classic, The Country of the Pointed Firs, in 1896, and it has remained a quiet evocation of the best of Maine. In a special edition published by Simon & Schuster, it is described as follows. It tells the story spanning 3 months' time in the life of a small coastal town called Dunnet Landing in 19th century Maine. A lone female visitor arrives and finds lodging with the widowed Mrs. Todd, the town herbalist, who introduces the visitor to many of the town's inhabitants. The visitor's impressions of the people she meets start out simply, and then almost invisibly they crescendo into a deep, intense human portrait. When I read this book, I am moved by the wisdom hidden in the simplicity of the story. The portraits of the people, the likes of whom are today my friends and neighbors, known and unknown. For Jewett, the place described is a best scape for living, in nature, at work, for community. It is a place to see, hear, smell, taste, feel, love, and celebrate the best of what we call home. At the end, Jewett writes, near the woods, we could walk along to the highest point. There above the circle of pointed firs, we could look down over all the island and could see the ocean that circled this and 100 other bits of island ground, the mainland shore and all the horizons. It gave a sudden sense of space, for nothing stopped the eye or hedged one in. That sense of liberty and space and time which great prospects always give. What a perfect definition of the spirit of Maine. Thanks for listening to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm Peter Neal.
You've been tuned in to Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a Leeds Island Books audio project, produced by Trisha Badger, theme by Casey Neal for Mock Turtle Music, hosted by Peter Neal. Visit pointedfirs.org for more information and find us on your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.